So while performing that, he took on the theme of police brutality. That's what he tackled in his performance at the BET Awards. You could see the performance. It's posted. Just go to our Facebook page at VOA1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Susan Shand will bring us this week's education report. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, Ashley and John Russell will tell us about recent actions taken by the Chinese government.
The Chinese government is taking extreme measures to cut birth rates among Uyghurs and other Muslim ethnic minorities. At the same time, it is urging some of the country's Han majority to have more children, the Associated Press has found. A small number of ethnic Uyghur and Kazakh women have spoken out about forced birth control methods in recent years. But a new investigation by the Associated Press has found that the treatment is far more common and systematic than once suspected. AP reporters used government numbers, state documents, and information from 30 people who had been detained or knew someone who had been detained in camps in western China. Government officials often order physical examinations of minority women to learn if they are pregnant, the AP reports. In some cases, officials also force such pregnancies to be ended through medical operations called abortions. And they order birth control, like intrauterine devices, to be used by minority women to prevent pregnancies.
The population control measures are backed by mass detention, both as a threat and as a punishment for failure to follow orders. Having too many children is a major reason people are sent to detention camps, the AP found. Parents who have three or more children are taken away from their families unless they can pay huge fines. Police raid homes to search for hidden children. After Gulnar Umarzak, a Chinese-born Kazakh, had her third child, the government ordered her to get an IUD, a device put inside the uterus to prevent pregnancy. 2 years later, in January 2018, four officials in military clothes came to her home. They gave Umarzak, the poor wife of a detained vegetable trader, 3 days to pay a $2,685 fine for having more than two children. If she did not, they warned, she would join her husband and a million other people of ethnic minorities in internment camps. To prevent people from having children is wrong, said Umarzak. They want to destroy us as a people.
The birth control campaign has created an environment of fear around having children. Across Xinjiang, birth rates fell nearly 24% just last year, compared to 4.2% nationally, government numbers show. The hundreds of millions of dollars the government puts into birth control measures has changed Xinjiang from one of China's fastest-growing areas to among its slowest in just a few years. That information comes from new research by China expert Adrian Zentz. This kind of drop is unprecedented, Zentz said. This is part of a wider control campaign to subjugate the Uyghurs. China's foreign ministry calls the AP report false and says the government treats all ethnicities equally and protects the legal rights of minorities. Everyone, regardless of whether they are an ethnic minority or Han Chinese, must follow and act as the law demands, said ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian when asked about the AP story. Under China's former one-child policy, officials had long urged or forced pregnancy prevention methods and even abortion on Han Chinese. But ethnic minorities were permitted 2 children, and 3 if they lived in rural areas.
Under President Xi Jinping, those rules have changed. In 2014, soon after Xi visited Xinjiang, the region's top official said it was time to put in place equal family planning policies for all ethnicities. In the following years, the government declared that instead of just 1 child, Han Chinese could now have 2 and 3 in Xinjiang's rural areas, just like minorities. State-supported experts in China have warned that large rural religious families were behind the bombings, knifings, and other attacks the Xinjiang government blamed on Islamic terrorists. Outside experts say the birth control campaign is part of a wider government effort to weaken Uyghur identity and culture. Adults are subjected to political and religious re-education in camps. Children face similar treatment in orphanages. It's genocide, full stop, said Joanne Smith Finley, a Uyghur expert who works at Newcastle University in Britain. It's not immediate, shocking, mass killing on the spot type genocide, but it's slow, painful genocide. 15 Uyghurs and Kazakhs told the AP they knew people detained or jailed for having too many children. Some received many years in prison as punishment. Government data showed that of 484 camp detainees listed in Karakash County in Xinjiang, 149 were there for having too many children. That made it the most common reason for holding people.
Women in detention camps are forcibly given IUDs and what appear to be pregnancy prevention vaccines, former detainees say. Women are also required to attend classes on how many children they should have. 7 former detainees told the AP that they were force-fed birth control pills or injected with fluids, often with no explanation. Many reported feeling tired or sick after. The women said they stopped getting their periods. After being released and leaving China, some went to get medical exams. They were told they were sterile or no longer able to get pregnant. It is not clear what former detainees were injected with. However, the AP got records from a Xinjiang hospital that suggest pregnancy prevention injections are a common family planning measure. Dina Nordibai, a Kazakh woman, was detained in a camp that separated married and unmarried women. The married women were given pregnancy tests, Nordibai said, and forcibly given IUDs if they had children. She did not get the device because she was unmarried and childless. One day in February 2018, Nordibai said, a Uyghur woman in the same cell had to give a speech admitting to what guards called her crimes. When a visiting official looked through the iron bars of their cell, the woman said in Mandarin Chinese, I gave birth to too many children. It shows I'm uneducated and know little about the law. Another woman, Gulbakar Jalilova, confirmed that pregnant detainees in her camp were forced to have abortions. She also met doctors and medical students who were detained for helping Uyghur women avoid punishment and give birth at home.
Looking back, Omerzak considers herself lucky. She was able to get the money to pay the fine, but was left deep in debt. For the next year, she attended classes with other wives of men detained for having too many children. She and her children lived with two local party officials sent to spy on them. When her husband was finally released, they fled for Kazakhstan. The IUD is still inside of her. It now causes her extreme back pain. For Omerzak, it is a daily reminder of everything she has lost and of the women she left behind. People there are now terrified of giving birth, she said. When I think of the word Xinjiang, I can still feel that fear. I'm John Russell.
Across the country are considering how and when to reopen their buildings as they plan measures to control the coronavirus. Many school officials are worried about the costs of operating under social distancing guidelines. Such costs include protective equipment, additional teachers for smaller classes, and more transportation to keep students spread out on bus rides. These costs are frightening for urban school systems, which are under financial pressure. They say they do not have enough money or space to make classes smaller. In Hartford, Connecticut, Superintendent Leslie Torres Rodriguez is very worried about how to pay for additional teachers. She said that now each classroom must have fewer students and social distancing is required. In some grades, she said, she has individual teachers with as many as 27 students in their classrooms. My budget would be non-existent, she said. Many schools are developing plans for at least some distance learning, but many are worried about the cost. Camden is one of New Jersey's poorest cities. Superintendent Katrina McCombs said costs for classroom cleaning and protective equipment are a concern for her. That is because the city depends on the state government for money. For the next 2 years, New Jersey predicts it will face a budget deficit of $10 billion. New Jersey has not yet produced rules for the reopening of schools. McCombs said she hopes the governor gives urban areas like Camden a lot of choices. She added that many of her students live with families that have more than one generation in the same house. These are at high risk for infection. I would hope that as the governor is rolling out those recommendations, they can take those factors into consideration, she said. The School Superintendents Association, AASA, and the Association of School Business Officials International say making social distancing possible in schools will be costly. The Virginia-based groups estimate that it will cost the average school system about $1.8 million. However, most schools are expecting budget cuts because of the weak economy. You have a significant increase in costs for school districts at a time when school districts are going to have less money, said Dan Dominic. He is executive director of AASA. Alexa Garvey is a school board chairwoman in the town of Stonington, Connecticut. She said it would cut costs if the state ended a rule for the summer that there should be only one student on each seat of a bus. The seats normally fit two children. She also had other questions. Does every child need a mask? She asked. What are our obligations to supplying those masks? Some schools have fewer problems. In the wealthy town of Greenwich, Connecticut, the school system has 12.2 students for every teacher. To keep up social distancing when buildings reopen, Superintendent Tony Jones has said they will have enough open spaces in their buildings to spread out the classes. I'm Susan Shand.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. James Knox Polk moved into the White House as the 11th President of the United States in 1845. Few had predicted that Polk would become president. Even he was surprised. Polk had come to his party's presidential nominating convention nearly a year earlier with low expectations. But the top politicians, including former President Martin Van Buren, failed to win a majority of votes. Convention delegates tried again and again to agree on a candidate. Eventually, Polk was nominated. A small number of delegates supported him. Then the delegates voted again. This time, Polk received all 266 votes. He became the first dark horse candidate in U.S. history to be nominated by a major party. In other words, he was someone no one thought would win, but he did. Polk was born in the southeastern state of North Carolina. When he was a child, his family moved west to Tennessee. At the time, Tennessee had few white settlers. Some considered it the wilderness. Polk's family did well there. His father became wealthy, buying land and enslaved people. His mother, Jane, who followed strict Christian religious teachings, gave her 10 children a good education. James was the oldest. He went to college, then studied law. When he was 25, he married an intelligent and wealthy young woman named Sarah Childress. The two never had children, but they worked together to launch Polk's political career. In time, Polk was elected to the Tennessee House of Representatives, then the National House of Representatives. There, he developed a close relationship with President Andrew Jackson. Since Jackson was called Old Hickory, Polk became known as Young Hickory. When Polk left Congress and returned to Tennessee to become governor, he supported Jackson's banking reforms. But soon the U.S. economy collapsed. Tennessee voters failed to reelect Polk as governor, not once, but twice. So Polk returned to his plantations and waited for a chance to re-enter national politics. In 1844, Polk traveled to the city of Baltimore to attend the Democratic Party's national convention. He thought he could perhaps win the nomination for vice president. Instead, he became the Democrats' candidate for president. Several months later, he narrowly defeated the opposing party's candidate in the national election. Historian Robert Mary wrote a book about Polk's presidency. Mary says one reason Polk won the election was the issue of Texas. Polk wanted to make Texas a state. He thought the United States could take possession of the area peacefully. The other leading candidates did not. Mary says the other candidates were right. The United States eventually went to war with Mexico. But Polk spoke for the American people. In the 1840s, many Americans liked the idea of expanding the country. They believed in manifest destiny, the idea that God wanted America to expand west, all the way to the Pacific Ocean, and take control of the continent. As a result, many voters supported Polk and his promise to add Texas to the United States. Polk took another unusual position in the 1844 election. He said if he won the presidency, he would serve only one term, that is, 4 years. Several previous presidents had served 2 terms. Polk told voters presidents might abuse their power if they held office too long. One term, he said, would be enough for him. But Robert Mary says there was more to Polk's one-term promise. It was a political bet. Polk thought if he said he would serve as president for only one term, other party leaders might help him win. Then those politicians could try again to win the presidency in 4 years instead of waiting 8. He was probably right. If Polk had not made the campaign promise, Mary says, Young Hickory would not have won. During the first days of his administration, James K. Polk famously listed the 4 things he planned to do as president. He wanted to reduce taxes on imports. He wished to establish an independent treasury. He hoped to settle the dispute with Britain over the Oregon border, and he wanted to get California for the United States. Less than 4 years later, Polk had realized each item on his list. He is remembered for greatly expanding the size of the United States. He successfully negotiated with Britain for U.S. control over territory in the West up to the 49th parallel. The agreement gave the U.S. the current states of Oregon, Idaho, and Washington. Below those states lay California. An American government minister once described California as the richest, the most beautiful, and the healthiest country in the world. The official said, "The port of San Francisco was big enough to hold all the navies of the world." He said, "Someday San Francisco would control the trade of all the Pacific Ocean." There was only one problem from the point of view of the U.S. government. California was part of Mexico. At first, U.S. officials attempted to buy California from Mexico, but Mexican officials refused even to talk about selling California to the United States. Shortly after the U.S. Congress approved statehood for Texas in early 1845, Mexico broke relations with the U.S. altogether. The following year, Mexican troops crossed the Rio Grande and clashed with American soldiers. In answer, President Polk asked Congress to declare war. He did not think the conflict would last long. He believed the U.S. declaration would quickly force Mexico to sell him the territory he wanted. Polk was wrong. Historian Robert Mary says, "The war with Mexico lasted longer, was more expensive, and cost more lives than Polk expected." But in the 1848 treaty that ended the war, Polk got the land he had wanted. Mexico recognized the independence of Texas and did not stop it from joining the United States. And it sold the areas that are now all or part of the states of Arizona, Utah, Nevada, New Mexico, Wyoming, Colorado, and, yes, California. President Polk kept his promise to serve only one term. After 4 years, he retired from the presidency, traveled for a few weeks, and then returned to Tennessee to settle in a new home. But Polk did not have much time there. He had been sick often throughout his life, but he became seriously ill during his travels. Only 3 months after he left the White House, Polk died. He left behind a much larger country, but a divided one. The issue was again slavery. Southerners argued that they had the right to take enslaved people into California and other former Mexican lands. Northerners opposed any further spread of slavery. The question was this: did Congress have the power to control or even ban slavery in the new territories? I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.